that wraps up our show. Sorry for any spoilers.
Yeah. If you haven't seen Inception by now.
Yeah.
Suckers. If you haven't seen Dark Knight by now. Yeah. Jeez. God.
All right. So, that's about it. I have been and always shall remain to be Nick Jobe of Random Ramblings of a Demented Doorknob.
And I guess I could be Rachel from Rachel's Real Reviews. If I were in a Christopher Nolan film, I'd be questioning that right about now. But for now, we'll just say that I am.
And this might have been the Demented Encyclopedia. Okay. Moving on. We are now at the only part of the show anybody listens to.
Nah, I'm sure some people tuned in for this one. It's not like you said Twilight and everyone went scampering.
That is true. The end.
I mean, you say Christopher Nolan, people are like, hey, yeah, I might listen.
Yeah. Okay. So, the monodialogues of the week. The last couple times you've been on this show, Rachel, I made you go last. I'm going to let you go first this time.
You're so kind. Mine's really short, though. So, don't get too comfortable. But mine is from The Dark Knight, because it's Christopher Nolan, and I'm actually doing Rachel's goodbye letter to Bruce that he never received because Alfred hid it from him. But here I go. Dear Bruce, I need to be honest and clear. I'm going to marry Harvey Dent. I love him, and I want to spend the rest of my life with him. When I told you that if Gotham no longer needed Batman, we could be together, I meant it. But now I'm sure that the day won't come when you no longer need Batman. I hope it does, and if it does, then I will be there, but as your friend. I'm sorry to let you down. If you lose your faith in me, please keep your faith in people. Love now and always. Rachel. Scene.
All right. mine is longer. It is from, speaking of Inglourious Bastards.
nice segue there from earlier.
I'm going to be doing Brad Pitt's introduction scene, actually.
Excellent.
So it's quite a bit of a monologue. There's actually one part that is not Brad Pitt, and it's near the end. So, here I go. And I've only practiced this, like, once, so...
I didn't practice mine at all.
If I mess up with the accent or the inflection, that's too bad. All right. My name is Lieutenant Aldo Rain, and I'm putting together a special team, and I need me 8 soldiers. 8 Jewish American soldiers. Now, y'all might have heard rumors about the Armada happening soon. Well, we'll be leaving a little earlier. We're going to be dropped into France, dressed as civilians. And once we're in enemy territory, as a bushwhacking guerrilla army, we're going to be doing one thing and one thing only. Killing Nazis. Now, I don't know about y'all, but I sure as hell didn't come down from the goddamn Smoky Mountains, cross 5,000 miles of water, fight my way through half of Sicily, and jump out of a fucking aeroplane to teach the Nazis lessons in humanity. Nazis ain't got no humanity. They're the foot soldiers of a Jew-hating, mass-murdering maniac, and they need to be destroyed. That's why any and every son of a bitch we find wearing a Nazi uniform, they're gonna die. Now I'm the direct descendant of mountain man Jim Bridger. That means I got a little engine in me. And our battle plan will be that of the Apache Resistance. We will be cruel to the Germans. And through our cruelty, they will know who we are. And they will find the evidence of our cruelty in the disemboweled, dismembered, and disfigured bodies of their brothers we leave behind. And the German won't be able to help themselves but to imagine the cruelty among the cruelty their brothers endured at our hands, and our boot heels, and the edges of our knives. And the German will be sickened by us, and the German will talk about us, and the German will fear us. And when the German closes their eyes at night, and they're tortured by their subconscious for the evil they have done, it will be with thoughts of us they are tortured with. Sound good? Yes, sir! That's what I like to hear. But I got a word of warning for all you would-be warriors. When you join my command, you take on a debit. A debit you owe me personally. Each and every man under my command owes me 100 Nazi scalps. And I want my scalps. And all y'all will get me 100 Nazi scalps taken from the heads of 100 dead Nazis. Or you will die trying. Scene.
Nice.
I kind of went back and forth between Nazis and Nazis there. But
Nazis.
Nazis. Because he says it Nazis. Yeah. But, all right. Now it's time for film versus film. We're going to do this a little differently than usual. We're going to do like a scene versus scene.
It's Inception versus Inception.
Yeah, Inception versus Inception.
Dream versus dream, yeah.
We're going to be arguing which scene was better, the van or the mountain, the snowy mountain.
We're not doing the hotel because that would obviously win. Yeah. There's no argument against the hotel layer, dream layer.
Yeah. We decided when we were talking about this that because the first idea was what, van versus hotel?
Well, I think I was just throwing out, you know, van versus hotel, hotel versus snowy mountain, just whatever, yeah. You know. And you're like, no, we got to get the hotel out of the equation. Yeah.
Whoever had the hotel would automatically win.
Yeah, you just say hotel and you've won automatically. Yeah. So.
Rachel is going to be arguing for the van, and I'm going to be arguing for the mountain.
And we're keeping it much shorter than normal.
Yes. We're going to try 30-second intros and outros and one-minute arguments.
Yeah, so wish us luck.
Yeah, all right. You can go first, Rachel.
Oh, you're so kind.
I know.
All right, let me get my stopwatch going so I know how long I've been rambling. The van scene's really fantastic because they think they've got this whole plan going, and then all of a sudden they get into the first layer of the dream sequence, which is the rain and the van, and all of a sudden there's a train coming down the road and people shooting at them, and they realize, oh my god, this Fisher guy has been trained, what are we gonna do? And so from there it is straight up improvisation, and it's really great to show how they handle that because they've had this wonderful plan and now it's just shot. End.
Wow. Okay.
It's 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So, keeping it short.
The mountain. The mountain has constant action of various degrees, including the snowmobile and the skis. Having Cillian Murphy basically be used to break into his own subconscious is just an awesome idea to begin with. And the reconciliation of him and his father, juxtaposed with the reconciliation of Cobb and his wife, is just a wonderful moment. And Christopher Nolan actually used a real-life avalanche. And I think that's it.
he used a what? I'm sorry.
He used a real-life avalanche.
Oh, avalanche. Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I didn't hear that word.
Yeah. He didn't want to do CGI, so he just...
Created
an avalanche.
I'm going to go start an avalanche over here for my movie.
Yeah.
That's how far the Batman franchise has taken him. He can create natural disasters.
Yes. All right.
Okay.
You got 1 minute to argue why the mountain is not as good as the van. I was going to say sucks, but, you know, it doesn't.
Well, none of it sucks.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to remember everything. There's a lot going on in that movie, and I'm trying to remember all of it to argue well enough, but thankfully I only have to argue a minute. So, all right. Here we go. First of all, the van clearly beats the mountain because there's no Arthur on the mountain. He's too busy in the hotel. So that automatically makes the van win over the mountain. Secondly, there's so much action on the mountain that sometimes I'm not sure who's after whom because everybody's wearing those white snow bunny costumes. And you got to wonder who's after who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. I lose Eames and Sadio or Ken Watanabe. I lose them at some point. And then, you know, they finally get through all of this and they're getting to where they need to be with the Inception. And then Mal shows up. And it's like, God, did we have to go there? Haven't we had enough of her? And she shoots Fisher, spoiler alert. So they were so close and then they just had to bring the Evil Dead wife in, because they, I mean, I'm, I know there's a point to it, but it just felt almost like a stretch, and I'm done.
Okay. You kind of stretch in there with Arthur's not in it.
Hey, that's not a stretch. That is my number one point, actually. That's the top of the list for me.
Okay,
here Arthur's not in it.
Okay. All right, here I go. Okay, the van. Really, it only has one real action sequence, which is being chased and shot at. Whereas, you know, the mountain has, you know, it has the snowmobiles, it has the skis, it has gunfire, it has grenades. You know, just, it has a real-life avalanche. And just has, and the van is just, you know, driving around and getting shot, trying not to get shot. And then, you know, the van has probably the most unintentionally funny scenes in the whole movie, which is the long fall from the bridge. It's like the longest fall ever. In both viewings, there were people laughing every time they went back to that bridge and the van falling down. So yeah, that's not that good. And I believe that's my time.
Okay. Closing argument. Okay. Sure. The van was a little, it incited some laughter whenever that showed it falling, but it reminded you, it kicked back in the fact that time is different from the dream world to reality, and even further down you go in dreams, and it was a great reminder for that. It had some great action. It was, you know, who doesn't love a great car chase? And it had some funny moments too with the driver turn around and say, everyone see that when everyone's asleep, and everyone just flopping around like puppets. So I think that's my time.
Okay. All right. The mountain is clearly better. There's more going on in the mountain. The van, you really only have kind of one thing. It's not as visually appealing, I guess, as the mountain scene. There's more conflict, more internal conflict with the mountain than the van. And again, going back to the reconciliation stuff, that's just like at the real heart of the movie, and it was excellent. And time. I think that was even harder than the Harry Potter ones.
Oh my god, yeah. Oh well.
And that's it for the D-bag. Do we have closing thoughts on Christopher Nolan?
I'm going to try to avoid the word awesome.
He's awesome!
He's awesome! I think he's still fairly young. I mean, I think he's in his 40s, maybe. So I think we are going to see so much more wonderful, not awesome, but wonderful stuff from him.
All right.
So I can't wait to see what else he has to cook up.
Yeah, I can't wait for Batman 3.
Batman 3, hopefully with Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a bad guy. Yeah. And nothing crappy. But I, except for Following, which I, not counting in this since I technically didn't finish it, I have never been disappointed by one of his films. As in, that was so god-awful I couldn't watch it again. So, he is definitely one of the best working directors today.
And that'll about do it for the main topic.
Yep.
Let's go on to the D-bag, where I asked what your general thoughts on Christopher Nolan's films are. Simon states, The Dark Knight is incredible, but I know the ending is flawed. Two-Face. Memento is overrated, though I know others disagree. And Following, I have seen cheap for ages, but I've never bought it. Should I buy it? Is it good enough? No.
No. I don't know if they have Netflix in London, but if you have Netflix or have a way to watch it free, you can give it a shot, but don't spend money on it.
Yeah, unless it's like, you know, $2 or something like that. But
right.
I doubt you'll probably watch it again.
Yeah, if someone gives it to you as a gift, okay. But yeah, don't spend money on it. Don't go there.
Tom says, Christopher Nolan is my favorite working director right now. Dark Knight and Memento are both amongst my top films ever. The Prestige and Batman Begins are also great, and even Insomnia is a well above average crime thriller. As for Following, I just managed to get my hands on a copy and am planning to watch it ASAP. Let us know what you think about that, Tom.
Yep, good luck.
Yeah. Even Tom here agrees that Insomnia is only just a well above average crime thriller. I agree with Tom here in his ranking, how Dark Knight and Memento are way up high, Prestige and Batman Begins are like right below that, and then Memento and Prestige. I'd probably put Dark Knight and Prestige up at the top, Memento and Batman Begins right in the middle, and then Insomnia below that, and then Following below that.
Yeah, that's exactly how I would do it. So,
right on. Let's just go without further ado. Let's move into Inception.
It was awesome. That's just like the word of the day for Nolan.
let's just say potential spoilers here.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Inception. I've seen it twice. Rachel's only seen it once.
Yes, sadly. I will see it again before it leaves the theater, though. Yeah. From hell or high water, I'm going to.
This is probably going to remain one of my favorites of this year, if not, like, my number one of the year.
It's definitely my favorite of the year so far. I know I haven't seen as much as you. I don't get to go out to the theater as much, and I'm just now catching things on DVD that came out earlier this year. This year's been such a crap fest, though. Oh, my God. It's been miserable. And I'm sitting here watching all this stuff on DVD, and I'm just saddened by all of it, but thankful at the same time that I did not spend money in the theater. And there have been maybe three or four films that I've liked. Mm-hmm. You know, I might have liked them a lot, but nothing has blown me away. And Inception finally did that this past weekend.
I think only one other movie this year has really just, like, blown me away and exceeded all my expectations. And that was my number one before Inception. And that was How to Train Your Dragon.
Oh, I didn't see that one. Yeah, and it's not on DVD yet. So.
Yeah, and I have no idea when it's coming to DVD either.
No, I don't either, and I'm waiting for it. But yeah. they may be waiting on the Christmas rush or something to sell, because I don't think it has any kind of release date at this time.
It doesn't. But yeah, that's been bumped to my number two now, because Inception is definitely my number one.
Yeah.
The first time I saw it, I understood it. Like, I wasn't one of the people who were really confused and had no idea what was going on.
Right.
I followed it pretty easily. And mostly because my mind thinks in multiple layers half the time. The second time, before I went to see it the second time, I read up some theories and things that could happen. And I watched the movie to see if those theories could hold true, and one of them did. And I want to talk about that one.
Sure. I'll do my best to remember from 4 days ago.
Yeah. That is that the main Inception of the movie was not Cillian Murphy's, but it was on Leonardo DiCaprio through Ariadne, Ellen Page, and Michael Caine.
Okay.
And Saito, I forgot, Ken Watanabe.
Mm-hmm.
There's a theory, basically, that Michael Caine and then the other two that I just mentioned just kind of worked together to create this elaborate Inception to get Leonardo DiCaprio to come to let go of his wife and finally accept what happened to her so he can move on. And if you watch, it really holds there's only one thing that goes against it, and that's the scenes that don't have Leonardo DiCaprio in them. Because if it's a dream based around an Inception on Leonardo DiCaprio, then why isn't he in some of the, certain scenes?
Right.
But then the argument against that is, well, you don't always dream about yourself. So, who knows?
Oh, I do. I am very egotistical.
But, you know, essentially, at the end of the movie, it raises the question, was the whole movie a dream? I think, without a doubt, yes, the whole movie was, you know, a dream within a dream within a dream within a dream within a dream.
You don't think any of it was real?
I think there's only one scene that's real. And really? that is the flashback of when his wife committed suicide. If you listen, and this was a point I read before I went and saw it, mixed in with the music of the scenes that take place during the supposedly real world scenes, mm-hmm. Is a ticking clock. And, you know, they always use the ticking, the sound of a ticking clock when they go into dreams to know, you know, how much time has gone on. So it makes you wonder if during these real life scenes that if, you know, they're just under, you know, in the dream then too. And at one point Michael Caine says something like, you know, you need to come back to reality. He tells that to Leonardo DiCaprio in what's supposed to be one of the real world scenes. Mm-hmm. And Leo's like, you know, I am in reality, I am awake, blah blah blah. And another big fault with Leo is that his totem, he used his wife, someone else's. So if it spins and falls over,
and it's not necessarily an indication that he's in reality.
Right.
Since it was his wife. Oh, okay. Because I was about to say that. What about his totem that would fall over when it wasn't supposed to? But yeah, if he used somebody else's, that would make sense.
So yeah, there's a lot of little clues in there. That hint. And the big question, especially with Ellen Page's character, was why does she seem so interested in Leonardo DiCaprio's emotional state and his, you know, personal life? Well, as Leonardo explains in the movie, the best way to perform Inception is through catharsis and, you know, an emotional connection. And you got to get to know these people pretty fast in order to perform it.
Right.
So it would make sense for her to be really going after him and figuring out what he's about, you know, all that kind of thing, getting to really get into his mind. And then at the end of the movie, there is that catharsis, which is actually juxtaposed with Cillian Murphy's catharsis with his father. So it makes you think.
Okay.
Oh, and I almost forgot to mention, Ariadne, I did a bit of research on this. Her name is kind of a clue, too, for two different reasons. First, she in Greek mythology, she was a woman who helped Theseus get through the maze, the labyrinth, to destroy the Minotaur, who the Minotaur could technically be considered as Maul, mm-hmm. his wife. And, you know, she's supposed to create these mazes and stuff throughout the movie. So there's that. And then there's a thing based off that called Ariadne's Thread, which is essentially kind of basically the idea of Inception, of going back, going back to something in the past and trying to change it. So, yeah, it's... look it up on Wikipedia. It makes more sense than what I'm trying to explain right now. But yeah, there's that's kind of a theory that I'm going with, is that the main inception of the movie was actually to Leonardo DiCaprio's character and not necessarily Cillian Murphy's.
Well, I would definitely have to watch it again and again before I could argue that. So I will take your word that is a possibility for the next time I watch it. I'll have to look out for those clues. Because I seriously cannot argue with you on this. Because, you know, you watch it once and there's so much to take in that my mind wasn't even going there.
Yeah, I didn't see it the first time either. I didn't even see it until I was looking for it. But I guess kind of leaving the whole theory aspect to talk about the movie itself... how awesome was the hallway fight
Oh my God, I wanted to marry that hallway play. It was incredible. That's actually the thing that got me interested in the film to begin with. Like I wrote in my, well, it wasn't really a review because there were no words I could think of late last night to finally get a review out. But I started off with telling about the first time I saw the teaser trailer last year at Inglourious Basterds. And, you know, I went back and watched the teaser, and there really isn't a whole lot at the beginning. It just says, you know, from the director of The Dark Knight, and you see Leonardo DiCaprio and a glass of water that looks like it's being tilted. And it's like, okay, well, what's this big deal? And then all of a sudden you see these guys kind of walking up the walls and fighting on the ceiling of this hallway. I'm like, whoa, where did this come from? And that hall, you know, just a snippet of that hallway fight is what got me interested in the film. So it's totally, and it, you know, that's only a fraction of the awesomeness that it is. And there goes the word awesome again. I can't think of a better word because brilliance.
It's awesome in like the original sense of the word. Like puts you full of awe.
Like, yeah. I mean, it really does. It was fantastic. Brilliant. I don't know.
Infuriating ending was perfect.
And see, I wasn't infuriated. I liked the ambiguity because it leads to conversation. And
well, no, I wasn't infuriated either.
People in my theater who were like, oh man, what? And I'm just like, you know, whatever, you're just an idiot. But it leads to conversations, because if Nolan sits here and tells us, oh, it was all a dream, or he is in the dream world, or he's not in the dream world, then what do we have to talk about besides, you know, the pretty visuals and the great acting and the originality? You know, there's nothing left to interpret at the end.
Do you think it was all a dream, or do you think there was some reality to it?
I'm hopeful that it was real, but I honestly believe it was a dream. The ending, as far as going back to the whole, the Inception was for Cobb's character. I don't know. I'd have to see it again. But at the end, I wish that he got back to see his children again, but I don't know. I believe that that's what it was. I really have to wonder if it wasn't just all a dream for him.
The reality scene that really started making me question if it was a dream, even in my first viewing, before I even, you know, knew that was how it was going to end, was when I think he's in Mumbai or what, some Indian town. And
or the chemist or Eames.
Yeah. And he's running from the guys, and he goes in between the two buildings, and it's like the buildings start closing in on him.
Yeah.
And he can't get out. And I'm like, that's just like a dream moment right there.
Right. Well, in the trailer, in the full length trailer, they show that part where he's sitting there talking to Ellen Page's character, saying, you know, dreams feel real while we're in them. Uh-huh. It's only after we wake up that we realize something was strange. And while he's saying that part, they're showing him trying to get through those two walls. And so I thought, definitely in the trailer, I was like, oh, that must be somebody's weird dream, you know, the claustrophobia and everything. And then they show it, and we're led to believe he's in the real world at the time, but that is a good clue as to maybe he was dreaming, because it certainly looked that way in the trailer. Of course, trailers can be misleading, as we all know, but in this case, it's hard to say which one, you know, if it truly is misleading, since we're dealing with dreams and versus reality here.
Yeah. There was one plot hole that I found on my second viewing that I wanted to bring up here real briefly. There were two things that happened, only one of them I can remember. Near the end, when they're in the three levels, there's the van, the hotel, and the snowy mountain.
Right.
The third level, the mountain, can hear the music, the kick warning music. From the van, but they don't feel the anti-gravity from the second level.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't answer that. Well, then again, I mean,
and there was something else from the first level that they got, but I can't remember what it was.
Well, as far as anti-gravity goes, I'm thinking, you know, everybody who's in the, you know, asleep in the second level, do they feel the anti-gravity? Mm-hmm. I mean, Arthur was awake, so he definitely felt it. And wasn't he was the dreamer for that one, wasn't he?
I don't remember.
I think so, because at the beginning, or when he and Ellen Page are sitting in the lobby and they're all staring and he gets her to kiss him, he says they're all looking for the dreamer, me. And I think he was the dreamer, so I don't know if it depends on who's doing the dreaming or the fact that they were all asleep and just suspended in midair, so they may not have known.
Yeah.
But they could still hear the music.
Yeah.
Because that's a completely different sensation. I could be talking out of my ass at this point. I saw it like 4 days ago.
I do have to say one of my favorite scenes, the small scene, is the kiss scene between
that's so cute.
Gordon Lovett and Ellen Page. It was worth a shot.
Yeah. Well, just pretty much anything with Arthur I loved.
Yeah.
I just love Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And Arthur and Ames, their whole little rivalry, their little playful rivalry.
Dream big with the gun.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a kick.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of their little moments were really great together. So I'm glad that it had some of that humor to break up the very intense, you know, setting and action and all that stuff. So, and actually on Joseph Gordon-Levitt, like I was talking earlier, when I wouldn't really call it a disappointment in the film, because I do like the way his character is executed, but I swear to God, that full-length trailer made him look like a straight-up villain. And so, I thought he looked like a villain in that full-length trailer, and so I was kind of hopeful to see Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing a bad guy. Not that any of them were good, since they were, you know, doing very illegal things in people's brains, but when he ended up not being, I was like, oh, I was kind of hoping for it. Just a minor letdown. I certainly didn't not enjoy the film based on that. It was just more manipulation from the trailer than anything.
Yeah.
So I thought so, but.
Anyway. I guess we'll leave Inception at that. especially since we're going to be talking more in depth
about it tomorrow
on the Lambcast. So moving on to the movie that really made Nolan like a massive name.
Yeah.
The Dark Knight. I remember when the casting of Heath Ledger as the Joker was announced.
That was controversial.
That was very controversial.
Oh my gosh. Everybody I knew that was really into film was like, what? Are you serious? Him? You know, it was so.
It's the guy from A Knight's Tale and 10 Things I Hate About You.
10 Things I Hate About You. Are you serious? And I got to admit, I was one of them. Uh-huh. I was like, what the crap? Heath Ledger? Seriously, Nolan's lost it. And he proved us all very, very wrong.
Very wrong. Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess Nolan definitely knew what he was doing with that one.
Yeah, and now I'm actually wondering, as are a lot of other people, especially due to Inception, with because you know the next film's got to be the Riddler. There's no way around it.
Right.
The big rumor here is Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
And I say hell yes. And when we get to Inception in a minute, I'll talk about one minor kind of sort of disappointment I had, but. I'll get to that in a minute, but yeah, I would love to see Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the Riddler. And we were talking about him versus Neil Patrick Harris the other day on Facebook.
Yeah.
And as much as I like Neil Patrick Harris, I would just expect him to burst out into Dr. Horrible song, I guess. But I haven't seen too many Joseph Gordon-Levitt movies. I've seen quite a few, but I haven't seen him play a bad guy yet. Mm-hmm. And I would love that so much. I think he's got it. I think he really has the menacing look, and I would love to see him as the Riddler. There's no uproar in a bad way from me over that.
But it's just kind of going to the Neil Patrick Harris thing. While I'm with you on the Joseph Gordon-Levitt, like, I think he'd be a great choice too. But Neil Patrick Harris would probably cause that same uproar that Heath Ledger had.
Yeah.
and the Riddler is a character that has to be equally as, like, funny and mesmerizing as he is with as he is menacing.
Right. And, so you don't end up just straight up cartoonish like Jim Carrey.
Yeah. Who just took the, you know, Jim Carrey just took the funny and, you know, not even mesmerizing. You just kind
of or menacing. I mean, there is nothing menacing about him except that that unitard he had going on.
And I think I actually think Neil Patrick Harris would be an interesting choice. And there's a poster out there if you search for it that has Neil Patrick Harris dressed up in a Riddler costume, and it looks really cool.
Yeah, you linked it to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do agree that Joseph Gordon-Levitt would probably be the best choice, with his, you know, his ability, especially that he showed in Inception. Mm-hmm. And overall, just the, I don't even know, I can't even fathom how Batman 3 is going to be.
You know, you hope that The Dark Knight wasn't the peak. But you have to wonder where can Nolan take the story from here and be just as awesome. So,
well, there was a lot of controversy. It's kind of scary. There was a lot of controversy with The Dark Knight after it came out too, because people weren't sure whether Two-Face was dead.
Right. You look pretty dead to me.
Yeah, I think he's dead, and I think Nolan announced that he was dead, maybe not Nolan, but.
They have, like, a funeral or something at the end? I haven't watched it in a couple months, but, like, at the very end, I remember maybe it was Gordon talking, and they had, like, his picture behind him. Like, they were almost having a memorial service of some kind, or am I making that up?
No, you're right.
I just took that to be, like, a memorial service or a funeral, and the guy was dead. I don't know why people are interpreting that he might come back.
Yeah. I think it was Aaron Eckhart, actually, that announced that Two-Face was dead.
Okay.
But yeah, there was also another interesting idea for Batman 3, and I know we're talking more about Batman 3 than The Dark Knight. but I mean, what hasn't been talked about The Dark Knight?
Yeah, it's like, what new can we say at this point? The movie's what, 2 years old?
Yeah.
Is it 2 years old now? And I mean, every possible thing can possibly be said. It's awesome.
Yeah, Heath Ledger was brilliant. You know, the movie was great. Christian Bale's voice was annoying.
Yeah. God, come on, Christian. What are you doing? But, yeah, I mean, it's just a brilliant film.
Anyway, one interesting speculation that I've heard that I thought would be good would be to introduce Harley Quinn, which is, you know, like the female Joker.
Yeah.
But you can't really do that without having the Joker, and they're not going to recast Heath Ledger.
Right. That would be a sin
if
they did that.
So. I think Nolan already said he refuses to do it.
Good. Smart man. And that's another thing. I mean, he makes, and maybe I should say this is the wrap up, but I'm not going to. He makes these big, huge blockbusters, but he doesn't seem to be one who's just after a quick buck.
Yeah.
Because if he were, he would do something stupid like recast the Joker.
Yeah.
Because he knows it would get people in the audience just to see it, just to compare. And that it's, you know, offensive to do something like that, and I'm glad that he's smart enough not to go down that road.
Yeah, I mean, over the last, if you count Batman 3, which is supposed to come out in 2012, over the last 14 years, he's only done like 8 films.
Yeah.
So he chooses pretty wisely.
Right, and it, you know, except for, well, of course, I don't think many people have seen Following, and excuse me, I don't think Insomnia was that big, but I mean, he really, or Memento probably wasn't either, but a lot of people have gone back and really shown love for it since then. I don't remember it coming out at the time. I just remember seeing it on DVD later, but I mean, once Batman Begins started, he really seems to be raking in the cash.
Yeah.
And I am very thankful that he got a chance to do the Batman franchise, the Batman reboot, because we get movies like The Prestige and Inception.
Yeah.
Because nobody, I mean, I think it took him, I think I read it took about 8-10 years for him to get Inception made.
From it's the about time 10 years, yeah.
Yeah. From the time he pitched it to the studio to this last summer, it took about, it was a 10-year process. And if things like, if films like Batman Begins and Dark Knight had not come along, I doubt that movie would have ever gotten made to the scale, to the beautiful scale that it was done.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm so glad that he was the one chosen, because he clearly has these very original ideas and he's getting these movies made because of the Batman franchise.
Yeah.
So.
The Prestige was his next movie. I think where The Prestige gained fame was in its rivalry, no pun intended, yeah. with The Illusionist.
Oh, okay. I personally, you know, before it came out, when I saw the first trailer, I called it the Batman versus Wolverine movie. Because, you know, we had X-Men going strong, and then on this new Batman reboot, just a year after after Batman Begins came out, I think, and we had this great, you know, two big superheroes going on up against each other. But, The Illusionist, it did go up against that, too, because they came out within, like, a month of each other, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, which do you prefer?
Actually, I saw The Prestige in theater, and then I didn't see The Illusionist in theater. I saw The Illusionist, I rented it, I believe, and saw it at home.
Yeah, so did I.
And at the time, I loved The Illusionist better.
Really?
Yes, because...
So you saw Prestige first?
I saw The Prestige first, okay. And then saw The Illusionist, and I actually... Throughout the film of The Illusionist, when I first watched it, and I've only watched it the one time, and I need to see it again, because I love Edward Norton and I love Paul Giamatti, and when I saw the movie, I was like, well, this is pretty average, but then it pulled a Saw on me, because I thought the same thing with Saw. I was like, this movie's pretty average, it's kind of predictable, blah, blah, blah. And then the ending comes, and the ending floored me of The Illusionist.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't see the ending to The Illusionist coming, whereas with The Prestige, I saw it coming a mile away.
Really?
Yeah.
See, that's totally the opposite. I was totally shocked by The Prestige, and The Illusionist, The Illusionist, I was like, oh, yeah, I got it. Like, halfway through the movie, I'm like, oh, okay, sure, I know what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was because I had just watched The Prestige, and because I think I saw The Prestige in the theater, and then when it came out on DVD, I rented it, and then watched The Illusionist for the first time not long after that. So I had just watched it. I was like, yeah, you're dealing with magicians. I know what it is. I think having seen The Prestige ruined The Illusionist for me, in that I pretty much knew what to expect when you're dealing with, magic.
Yeah.
So...
But let's just put it this way. I own The Prestige, and I do not own The Illusionist.
Yeah, same here.
I've come to love The Prestige much more now that I've seen it, a couple more times.
Mm-hmm.
The rivalry between Bale and Hugh Jackman is great. And then, just having, what's his name?
Michael Caine.
Well, yeah, Michael Caine, but that's not the one I was thinking of. David Bowie.
Oh, Bowie.
Yeah.
Tesla.
As Nikola Tesla.
And Andy Serkis as his assistant.
Yeah. Because, you can't go wrong with Bowie. Unless you give him a cod piece.
All right, there. For me, I love The Prestige the moment I saw it. And with The Illusionist, I definitely thought it was a lesser film. And not even because I saw the ending coming a mile away. I don't blame The Illusionist for that. What it all boils down to with The Illusionist, for me, is when you get down to it, it's just a love story. That's all it is, really, for me. I just saw a love story. With The Prestige, you get into the darkness of how far man will go when their rivalries clash, and how far, you know, their love for magic took them and how it ruined them and their lives and the women they loved. Mm-hmm. And I just watched it again about a week ago. And, you know, the first time I watched it, I really liked it, and then got the big shocking ending for both men. And then second time I watched it, you know, just picking up on the little things. And this last time I watched it, I thought, damn, those poor women. I mean, that it is a tragedy for those women who put up with everything they did mm-hmm. with those men. And that's, I mean, it just, there's always something new I find about it every time I watch it. And like I said, for The Illusionist, I haven't seen it again. I probably would give it another shot, but I don't think it has as many layers as The mm-hmm. Prestige does.
Yeah, I'll definitely agree with that. The Prestige, actually, thinking about it, it's almost kind of a forefront or forerunner for Inception. It really had, like, this story within a story within a story aspect going with it, with the journals or the diaries or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then it could get kind of confusing at times if you really stop to think about it, because it's like one character, I think Hugh Jackman is reading the diary of Christian Bale, who at one point is like reading the diary of like Hugh Jackman.
Right. Right. And, well, yeah. I think Christian Bale's in prison. So in the timeline of the story, that's toward the end, and he's reading Jackman's journal.
Yeah.
Who at some point in his writing of his journal talks about getting Christian Bale's old journal, which of course ended up being a trick. So yeah, there is a story within a story there.
But
and then also, you know, it actually leaves there's a lot of ambiguity of what really happens. I mean, there are the twist endings, but
yeah,
there are things that can be argued one way or the other. Mm. And, you know, there's none of that in the Batman movies, and not even really Memento as much. There's not as much ambiguity in Memento. It is like, it is a pretty straightforward story just shown backwards.
Yeah.
So, but there, you know, I've seen people who've argued how Hugh Jackman's character pulled off the things that he did, and that was he cloning himself or was he not? Was it really just a trick?
Mm-hmm.
So it's also left to interpretation, which Nolan's other films, except for Inception, now really aren't as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I have, like I said, grown to love it more, and it's definitely an excellent film. Some even consider it to be Nolan's masterpiece. I don't think I'll go that
until
far.
Until this last Friday.
Yeah. I've even read a review that says Inception's still not as good as The Prestige, which is kind of shocking to me. But anyway. All right. Next is the film that brought Nolan to be Nolan, which is Batman Begins in 2005. Yeah. To me, Batman Begins was was a very good reboot to the series, but I'm not sure it exactly holds up to repeat viewings. It's still really good, but it gets kind of dull at times, at least to me, and especially in comparison with The Dark Knight. So yeah, what are your opinions on?
Well, first of all, it's got Katie Holmes in it, so I have to wonder what the hell Christopher Nolan was smoking when he picked her to be Rachel Dawes. And thank God he, you know, sobered up for The Dark Knight and got Maggie Gyllenhaal. But I've, you know, seen it several times. It's definitely not as great as The Dark Knight, but I remember prior to it coming out, and just hearing about it, saying, oh, they're rebooting Batman. Because that was kind of near the beginning of when all the rebooting started.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? I mean, is this a sequel? And people are like, no, I think they're starting from scratch. I'm like, oh, come on. This is just dumb. And even when someone said Christian Bale was going to be in it, I was like, eh, I don't care for it. And then the first trailer came out. I'm like, well, this might have the potential to be okay. And then it was finally like a great comic book film that didn't totally feel like a comic book. Mm-hmm. Or feel like it was totally based off a comic book. And I still enjoy it. I have watched Dark Knight far more than Batman Begins. But just as a start to this new reboot of the franchise, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's got Liam Neeson and lots of Cillian Murphy, so yeah. That's why.
I think the biggest fault of the movie is in its villains.
Really?
I love Cillian Murphy and Liam Neeson, but he chose some like lesser villains for this first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're lesser villains, they're not necessarily as interesting villains as, you know, because if they were more interesting, more people would know about them, like the Joker, the Riddler, you know, things
right.
like that. I like Scarecrow. I actually knew. I didn't really know Ra's al Ghul, but I did know Scarecrow from the cartoon. And I like Cillian Murphy, and I like the idea of the Scarecrow. So I like that aspect of the story. But for it is in essence the very definition of a origin story.
Right.
And just like, you know, Spider-Man, origin stories don't always live up to, you know, the first time you watch it. 'Cause it's got to introduce so much in, you know, such a time limit, and then get to the actual superhero thing that it just doesn't hold up for multiple viewings. Like, say, The Dark Knight does.
Well, I mean, you're talking about the villains not being as known or exciting, but I think it works to the advantage of the movie in that since it is an origin story, you want more focus on Batman and Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
Bruce Wayne to kind of get, you know, his backstory started. And, I mean, I think that was a big problem with the very first Batman with Michael Keaton. You want to introduce the superhero, start a franchise, but you put someone like the Joker in there, and then you put Jack Nicholson, who is so over the top as the Joker and so cartoonish, that it took a lot of focus off Batman.
That's true. That is,
and I think with this reboot, you know, Nolan knew, I mean, he'd already signed on to do two films. Bale had already signed on to do three from the beginning, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so they knew they were going to have a franchise. They knew there were going to be sequels. They wanted it to be about Batman and not the villain. And I think that's where the big mistake was the first time around. So this time it was like, well, let's focus on Batman, and we'll have these lesser known villains who are still great. And another great thing about these villains is Scarecrow. I mean, that could have been such a cartoonish joke.
Yeah.
But the way they did it, he was very rooted in reality. I mean, all he did was put on a creepy mask and just shoot some drugs at people, and they totally freaked out. And that, you know, that really, I think that's the aspect that really pulled the new reboot into more of a real world instead of just the cartoonish comic book world that we had seen for the previous four movies.
I want to clarify here. I still really, really like the movie. I'm not trying to be negative.
Right. But it's one of those you can't rewatch as often as The Dark Knight.
Right.
But I will defend it in saying that I think that I like the way they did it to really set up, you know, put more focus on Batman because he is the title character.
That's a good point. I think that's about it for Batman Begins.
Oh, and just to let you know, I went back and looked up Insomnia. It was not a book, but it was a movie.
Oh, it was a movie?
Yes, so this was a remake of a movie.
All right, then.
So.
Okay.
And it looks like it was a Swedish film.
Oh, those Swedes.
Yeah, so.
Next is 2002's Insomnia. I have to say, I think this is the first Nolan film I saw in theater.
Me too.
And I don't think I realized, well, because I hadn't seen Memento at this point, I saw Memento a few years later. I don't think I knew who Christopher Nolan was when I saw it.
Same here.
And actually, just recently, within the last couple years, did I realize that Insomnia was a Christopher Nolan movie, and it makes me want to go back and watch it, because I don't think I've seen it since theater.
Yep, I pretty much echo exactly what you said. I saw it in the theater in college with my mom. I can't even tell you why we went to see it. Mm-hmm. If I was in school and she was visiting me, and we had a very small town with a small theater and just a few screens, so it might have been one of the only things to watch that we wanted, that we both could agree on. But we went, and I remember really liking it when I saw it. Mm-hmm. I just haven't watched it since. And I think I found out within the last year that it was a Christopher Nolan film.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, I can't believe I saw a Christopher Nolan film, you know, before he became
Christopher
really
Nolan.
Popular.
Yeah.
Before he, you know, became popular with everyone. So, but yeah, I remember liking it. I remember liking the fact that Robin Williams was playing a bad guy.
Yeah.
Freaking Robin Williams. And the whole concept of, you know, murder, mystery, thriller that takes place in Alaska where the sun, at a time when the sun never sets, that was really interesting too. I just don't remember too much more about the film.
Yeah.
And I would like to go back and see it because I do remember liking it.
Yeah, I remember thinking it was pretty good. And I like to see it now again, especially because I've actually spent 2 weeks in Alaska during the summer when there's only like maybe 1-2 hours of darkness at the very most. And I can like relate to that even more now.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's one I definitely need to check out again, but like you, I don't really remember any of it. So,
I remember people who were in it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Robin Williams being the bad guy who ended up doing whatever. And I remember Al Pacino having some kind of problem because he was the one who had the insomnia and couldn't sleep. But that was about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I remember Maura Tierney running the hotel he was staying at and Hilary Swank being like the chief deputy there in the small Alaskan town.
Well, so you remember a little more than I do.
Then I'm out. I've got nothing left. I remember liking it. That's about it.
Well, that was... I think it's pretty much the same with a lot of people. Insomnia is like the... almost like the redheaded stepchild of of Christopher Nolan's films. It's not the most recognized.
Right. Well, I mean, it is a fairly, compared to his other work, it is fairly standard.
Yeah.
So it's just a stepping stone. Well, I guess it'd be almost a step back. I mean, I don't want to say step backwards from Memento because they are two completely different films, but in terms of originality, it is a bit of a step backwards.
Isn't it based? No, well, it wouldn't be. I had a thought that it was based on like a Stephen King book, but I might be wrong there. Because
I don't know.
Because most of his books are in Maine, not Alaska. So
right. I don't think so.
I know it's based on a book, but I'll have to double check on that.
Okay.
Moving on to a much more well-received film, Memento, in 2000. Rachel, you want to start us off on this one?
I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, what the crap is going on? Because I didn't know anything about it. I had no clue. No, I mean, nobody had told me a word about it. I'm just sitting there thinking, what is going on? And then I realized, oh, okay, it's playing backwards. Well, that's interesting. And the thing that I love about that movie, you see the ending first, and it plays backwards, yet there's still so much mystery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you always think, oh, once you get to the ending, the mystery will be revealed. No, once you get to the beginning, the mystery is revealed. And that is such a cool, but technically it is the ending of the film. And it's such a cool concept.
Yeah, actually, I love the fact that he created the twist at what's essentially the beginning of the story, but had to play it backwards, you know, for it to actually be considered a twist.
Right. Because, if you learn the twist at the beginning and then watch the film, it's, you know, rather boring.
Which you can.
Right.
On the DVD, I think there is an option of letting you watch the movie in chronological order.
I think I have the poor man's version of the DVD. I don't think I have that one.
But yeah, it's I really enjoyed this movie the first time I saw it. I've only seen it a couple times since, and it's been enjoyable. I think after a few viewings, it kind of loses its novelty a bit. Mm. But it's still brilliant and, you know, a great original idea, despite, you know, being, I don't think it counts when movies are based off short stories that you or like a relative wrote, you know?
Right. Right. I would agree with that. I mean, it's his brother for crying out
loud. Yeah. It's like, you know, if I wrote a short story and my sister directed a movie based on it, it just doesn't, it's still not, it's just like writing the screenplay and saying it's based on.
Yeah, just
on,
collaborating with
yeah.
them.
Yeah. But anyway, what I really liked about it, besides just the playing backwards, was also that it part of it was playing forwards. It's like the beginning of the movie was playing in chronological order, while the end of the movie was playing in reverse chronological order, and they meet up at the middle.
Right.
And, because the regular chronological is what, it's like in black and white.
Yeah. Where he's telling the story.
Yeah.
To whoever he's talking to on the phone, right. Mm. Yep. And it finally all kind of comes together.
Yeah.
So.
So yeah, that's pretty much Memento, and I always recognize the guy who plays is his name Teddy?
Teddy, yeah, or yeah. John G. Yeah, Joe Pantaleone.
Yeah, Pantaleone.
Yeah.
And
something Italian I can't pronounce.
The guy from The Matrix. I obviously saw Memento after I saw The Matrix, since The Matrix came out first. But every time I see that guy, no matter what it is, even like he was just in Percy Jackson, and I'm like, it's the guy from The Matrix.
Wasn't he in The Goonies?
Was he?
Back in 1980, he was one of the stupid brothers. Wasn't he? If I'm wrong, please cut this out of the final recording. I am pretty sure he was one of the brothers, so. Well, I always remember him from The Goonies.
We'll check that later. Next is... What? Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you were saying that it kind of loses some of its novelty after watching it multiple times. That's why I kind of wait a good couple of years between each watching.
Yeah.
Because then I forget all the little things, and then when I rewatch it, I pick up on those again, and it's almost like watching it for the first time again.
Yeah.
Only less confusing.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, definitely one excellent and very original concept for a film.
Yep.
Not even so much in the writing, just the execution, clearly.
If only someone did a podcast like that.
If only. Yeah. They would be geniuses.
They would be. What we're going to do here is go one by one, starting with his earliest films and going up through Inception. So, that being said, I'm looking at his IMDb right now, and he apparently had a movie called Doodlebug in 1997. I've not seen or heard of it.
I think it's a short. I think I checked that one, and that's a short.
Okay. So his first full feature-length movie was Following in 1998. In my opinion, it's like a poor man's Memento. I did not like it at all, really. It's basically taking the idea of mixing things around, like, time-wise, like Memento did, but just doing it with a story and characters that aren't anywhere near as interesting. It's only like 70 minutes long, and it's a really long 70 minutes.
Yeah. Or 35, if that's all you've watched of it.
Yeah.
Like me. I started it last Wednesday night because I was like, oh, I'm going to watch all of Nolan's films, except for the Batman movies, because I've seen those a million times each. but I decided to sit and watch Prestige and Following and Memento, and I got to Following, and it was on Netflix. Watch instantly. I was so pumped, but I had to write a post for the next day for my blog, and then I just realized I was way more into writing my post than I was paying attention to the television, because nothing terribly exciting was happening on my TV. So I, after about 35, 40 minutes, I was like, okay, I'll just start over later and rewatch it. And I never got around to it. So,
yeah.
Oh well.
When I watched it, at first I was so confused. I had no idea what was going on. And it took me a while. It took me until about halfway into the movie before I realized that these two stories were happening, you know, not at the same time.
Right.
And
that was like the same guy.
Yeah.
Because he got a haircut and slicked it back. And I'm like, is that the same guy? Is that the same writer guy from the beginning? And
yeah.
It was. So.
I mean, I think it has an interesting concept of, you know, just following people and then going through their stuff to, you know, kind of figure out who they are and all that. But it just, I don't think it was executed very well.
No, it was, I mean, it was rather tedious.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even get through with the whole thing. So maybe one of these days, I don't know how it ended. I just know it began and I wasn't terribly interested to learn how it ended.
I have to be honest. It's, I don't even remember the ending. I just kind of remember bits and pieces, like him following people down the road or looking through like underwear drawers.
Right.
And I didn't even remember the you know, shave and hair change until you brought it up.
Yeah.
But anyway, so main topic, Christopher Nolan. Do you want to talk about just your thoughts on his kind of style of filmmaking, Rachel?
Sure. He's awesome.
That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah. Why draw it out? Even though most of his works, except for his very first film, first full-length feature Following, and then now Inception, have been based on previous material like comic book for Dark Knight and Batman Begins, or short stories. I know, I think it's Memento. His brother had written,
yeah.
Jonathan Nolan had written as a short story, and he adapted to a screenplay. And even The Prestige was a novel.
And Insomnia was a book, too.
Insomnia, yeah, thank you, Insomnia. I knew I was forgetting one. They just feel so original.
Mm-hmm.
Everything he touches, just, it feels like something that really has, I mean, it has been done before, but just not to the degree that he can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So he definitely has a flair of, I guess I'll just use the word originality. I can't think of anything better, because, I mean, that's just the most basic word for him.
Yeah.
Definitely has a very original style.
So, first, I want to do a quick plug, and I think Rachel has something to say as well. I recently started a secondary blog called Breaking the Meta Wall, and it focuses on my creative writing. I don't update it as often as I update my movie blog, but if you're interested, check it out. Rachel?
Yeah, I don't think I really have anything.
No?
Just, you know, check out my site and my Real Insight podcast with Jess from Insight into Entertainment.
Yep.
After you're done listening to this, of course.
Yes. All right.
And, yeah, that's about it.
Okay.
Same as last time.
All right. Today, if you've noticed, well, you probably have, without Travis's voice there at the introduction, he is not here again, and Rachel has joined me for this episode to take his place, and we are going to be talking about Christopher Nolan, since his new masterpiece of a movie, Inception, just came out. Hey everyone, it's Nick Jobe from Random Ramblings of a Demented Doorknob.
And Rachel from Rachel's Real Reviews.
And this is the Demented Encyclopedia